Water Coolians, welcome back to a new episode of This Here Podcast. In today's episode, we are joined by sports agent and consultant Adam Lee Spencer to talk about pressing issues within the sports world. From the fading shine of hosting major international sporting events, the optics behind a lucrative contract, and the significance of representation in sports journalism. In our first news story, we discuss the diminishing allure of a country hosting a grand-scale international sporting event like the Olympics or World Cup, for example, as the extensive infrastructure needed for these events can lead to further issues for host cities if they're not properly planning out into the future beyond the event itself, and how the ever-rising costs associated with hosting a major sports team has reshaped many local communities. I'm sure many of our U.S. listeners know the strain of a billionaire owner telling you, you need to pay for my stadium, so I'm going to stay here, otherwise I'm leaving. Oakland, yeah, it happened, Oakland. Then we shift to the groundbreaking implications of NIL deals in college athletics and how those deals have sparked conversations about the distribution of wealth within the college ranks and now even into the major leagues and who should rightfully be the benefactor as revenue shares continue to skyrocket. We continue to see more and more money within the sports leagues from, you know, broadcasting rights, from revenue, from merchandise, from sales, anything and everything. Who should be the benefactor in that? And finally, in our second news story, we revisit how stories have been told about iconic athletes like Allen Iverson to shed a light on the importance of representation in sports journalism and the importance of understanding an athlete's background and culture to help shape nuanced and truthful sports narratives. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is episode 94 of Water Cooler Talk Podcast titled Nuanced Sports Takes with
Adam Lee Spencer.
Enjoy.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.
I can remember being about maybe 3 or 4 years old, and I had a microphone. And I remember the NFL Today, and I'm going to show my age now, but Brent Musburger saying, looking live from Lambeau Field in Green Bay, or you're looking live from the Metrodome in Minnesota. That grabbed me. And Bryant Gumbel was on television at the time also doing sports. So growing up as a child, you know, obviously wanted to be involved in sports and play in sports. As an adult now, I can look back on it and realize I didn't have that button in me that could flip to have the necessary edge.
You kind of need that crazy amount of I'm determined to completely change my life for this one goal. And I mean, I think everybody has that. They just have it in very different ways for very different things.
Yeah, I didn't realize that till I was pretty much pushing 30. And I had already started my military career. So it hit me then that, that makes a lot of sense. That explains a lot.
Yeah, I remember facing my first 80-plus mile per hour fastball in baseball. I was like, yeah, you know what? Maybe this isn't for me.
Oh, it was the curveball at your knees in Little League.
Yep. I mean, getting back to what you said about kind of Musburger and, you know, just announcers. And I think, obviously, being in the space, you know, you get so used to working with people who commentate on a lot of things. And it does. It brings a, you know, a totally different aspect to watching sports when somebody can do it very well. I mean, people give Joe Buck a lot of shit, but he also is a pretty good commentator. Or even, I mean, I'm a huge New Orleans Saints fan, and I remember that first game back from Katrina in the dome when Gleason does the punt block and then they recover it for the touchdown against Atlanta. And I remember that call, or even, you know, recently here in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Miracle, the call by one of our local radio people, Paul Allen. It does. It changes, you know, a really cool moment into a iconic moment. So I kind of understand what you're saying there.
Yeah, obviously those things. And then growing up also, I can look back on it now and say I really looked up to my dad, his brothers. And it was almost like a rite of passage for me and my cousins right around the same age as me. To be around them, you had to be able to do two things. Talk about sports, talk about politics. And so it was almost like a rite of passage to be able to sit with them and talk about sports. So you had to know what you were talking about, or at least be loud enough to make everybody think you knew what you were talking about.
Well, yeah, and obviously as we get into this episode, we'll talk about it. But yeah, the ability of sports to build communities and connections and friendships is so vital to what makes wanting to go to a game and wanting to support a team, you know, so special, because you find bonds where you otherwise wouldn't.
Yeah, and I understand the sentiment, but I hear people say that a lot, and it kind of makes me cringe at times, because do we all get on the same page for the team? Sure. Do we all get on the same page maybe for the cause? Yes. But I think that's where the guardrail kind of hits us at. Is that, okay, yes, we are supporting the team, or yes, we are supporting the city. From a social perspective, we have to be very careful with that, because as people, we're still going home in different directions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I mean, even to that, I think it does, you know, at least give the aspect of showing, like, if we are coming from different backgrounds, if we do believe in, you know, different things, at least for a moment, we can find connection. And if we can find that connection in that moment, why can't we find connection in other moments?
I think that's definitely an interesting way to look at it. The reason why I bring that up is because I think sometimes we go too far with that the connection in the moment of Game 7, World Series, walk-off home run to win it, and the crowd in the city and everybody's going crazy. Okay, fine. But then you have, you know, what transpired, what was it, 2 weeks ago now in Kansas City at the parade, and all the innuendo and all of the nonsense that occurred within that situation. It's something that we have to keep in perspective. Yes, it can bring us together, but we still have to deal with each other once the celebration is over.
Yeah, I appreciate that perspective. And it kind of perfectly goes into this first news story talking about how these stadiums and these communities are impacted by, obviously, sports. So, Adam, are you ready to jump into our first news story of the episode here?
Let's go.
All right. This first news story finds its way from Financial Times Opinion, written by Josh Noble, November 22nd, 2023. Why the race to host world sporting events has slowed to a halt. The battle to host the most watched sporting event in the world was over before it even started. The Men's Football World Cup, the 2020 World Cup final, had more than 1.5 billion viewers, will land in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia in 2034 after a bid from the country arrived unopposed. Spain, Portugal, and Morocco will jointly host the 2030 tournament after having seen off rival bids from, well, nobody. A joint UK-Irish bid for UEFA Euro 2028 strolled to victory in its one-horse race. World Rugby decided to handpick the US to hold their World Cups in 2031 and 2033. But it's not always been this way. British royals, American presidents, and French football stars would crisscross the globe, glad-handing officials and talking up the lavish temples to physical prowess that would be built, a obviously great expense to the taxpayer if their country got the nod. As the cost of winning a bid has soared, the once noisy jamboree of lobbying has turned into something more like a papal conclave, in which officials make deals behind closed doors and present the outcome in a haze of white smoke. The escalating costs associated with hosting major events, you know, Rio de Janeiro, who hosted the 2016 Olympics, spent more than $13 billion. 30 years later, Montreal finally paid off debts from hosting the 1976 Summer Olympics, have prompted action towards more sustainable hosting models. As a number of teams and events increase to allow organizers to sell extra rights to broadcasters, host countries face mounting challenges. Los Angeles, which will host the 2028 Summer Olympics, plans to leverage existing facilities, walking away with a financial surplus. While tighter control over hosting decisions may make commercial sense, concerns linger over transparency and accountability. The shift towards closed-door deals, bending to autocratic regimes, will do little to improve the reputation of an industry not exactly known for its ethics. So, Adam, as we've seen this shift away from, you know, the rabid enthusiasm of hosting world sporting events or, you know, building new stadiums, even in a time where sports have firmly inserted themselves into the fabric of our culture, do you believe there's are underlying factors, you know, driving this gradual shift in perspective outside of the quote unquote cost? Or, I mean, is it really as simple as becoming too financially undeliverable?
Well, I think we have to take bits and pieces out of it. For our perspective as Americans, we're always going to be a viable host. I've got 20 to 30 major cities that can open up an NFL stadium. We move some things here, do some modifications there. I can hold a World Cup match. Within that city, there's probably an aquatic center, large golf course, 15 to 20,000 seat basketball arena. Now, within that city, within an hour's drive, there's a college campus, another, depending on the state, at least 40 to 50,000 seat football stadium. Take a couple of things down here, move a few things around here. We've got the track facility. Once again, there's an aquatic center. Depending on the school, there's at least a 9 to 10,000 seat basketball arena. There's the volleyball tournament. All I've got to do is do a low budget version of Chip and Joe, a little extra paint, throw up some signs, and I'm good here. What has also happened is the sports in general have tried to go to your less name brand places, if you will, for lack of a better term. Okay, if you look at what UEFA's doing with their soccer tournaments now, you look at the youth level, a lot of those tournaments are now countries that were formerly in Russia, formerly behind the wall. For them to host a tournament, we need Chip and Joe and a few other contractors to come in, revamp the big stadium. The smaller towns, I've got to go in and now have them build a stadium or do a total remodel of the stadium. That means they know they have the tournament 2-3 years ahead. So they're going through and redoing wholesale changes. What you also have to understand with this is that these governing bodies, leadership organizations, whatever, come in to get a briefing on the bid, let's say. They're coming in asking questions about hospital facilities, transportation, hotel, where can we eat, goods and materials to make said country's players feel a little more at home. And when you start to talk about Europe or a Middle East or an Asia where it's not like the U.S. where, okay, I need some oranges, I'll go to California or Florida. Need some potatoes, I'll come out here to Eastern Washington or Idaho. Okay, let's get some peaches. Okay, we'll go down to Georgia. For the most part with the U.S., so much of the materials and the sources and the products needed are right here. I step out of the U.S., I got to call somebody now. I got to make sure I'm on the same page with this country to get goods in, or at least can be transactional enough to be able to cut a deal with them to make sure we can get the products in, to make sure in a relatively reasonable way, folks are taken care of. You've got situations where, let's just say Europe, certain countries don't play against each other, or from that, can't play against each other in the early rounds. If they happen to play against each other in the knockout stages, okay. But they can't play against each other because of some of the old war wounds that are still there. So you have that challenge. Some of the issues in a public format, when you talk about behind-the-scenes stuff, goes back to something I got to take a small part in is World Cup in 2006 in Germany. The Germans won the bid from what was supposed to be South Africa, because if you remember, after 2006, the World Cup went to South Africa in 2010. Mm-hmm. But the Germans won the bid in 2006 because of basically money changing hands. This is where if you look up FIFA history, a guy named Jack Warner and some other folks got in trouble for financial kickbacks. So that World Cup, which at the time I was stationed in Germany, but we were in Iraq at the time. I came back on R&R for 2 weeks in May of that year. So I missed the World Cup by about a month or so. The Germans were all getting ready for it. They still have monuments and different things up from that. They still have walkable areas set up now that are specifically walkable and, you know, not so much touristy, but, you know, just local centers that came from setting up things from that World Cup. Okay, so let's take a look. You mentioned Brazil. You mentioned the 2016 Olympics. Half of the issue is the 2014 World Cup was played there. So if you go back to the World Cup in 2014, their issues were with the pay and taking care of third-party nationals coming in to work to get stadiums built.
The same issue in Qatar.
Right. Some of the Qatar stuff goes back to 2014 in Brazil. All right. The issue with Brazil, and I'm going to stress this, this is the country of Brazil. By 2016, 2017, they were talking about soccer stadiums in Brazil that were built or refurbished, whatever you want to call it, for that particular tournament. Now have weeds and grass and ivy growing up within the stadium because the stadium's not used anymore. So you have that issue. And then they built facilities for an entire Olympics. And Brazil is a country where, you know, if you follow international politics, their politics can get out of pocket quickly. If you look at the life and times of the great Pelé, you'll also know about the dictatorship that was in place when he was at the height of his powers. There's always been a chaotic political background playing itself out in that country. So there's a part of that also. Go to 2008. Beijing, well, China as a whole, got the Women's World Cup and an Olympics right around the same period. We know our different feelings about a political situation in China. We know how that can get a little out of pocket. So there's that. And that was during a period when especially the IOC and a lot of the other international governing bodies attached to the Olympic sports were going to a lot of the old autocratic or at the time still autocratic countries trying to broaden the sphere, which in theory, no problem. But it came with a price. The price became these CNN documentaries that would come out 2 or 3 years after a tournament, talking about the atrocious working conditions, talking about the treatment of workers, talking about the issues with third-party workers. Some of it's obvious political unrest that's constant in some of these countries. There's the obvious financial requirements that come with putting on a tournament, not in the U.S. where you've got to build facilities. You've got to build transportation routes. You've got to build hospitals. You've got to build lodging facilities. And so a lot of the planning and a lot of the things that come with it, there's a pre, there's an execution, and then there's an aftermath. And the aftermath a lot of times becomes the true failure because you don't have a plan in place after the games stop. If you look at London 2012, they actually at least tried to put an effort in place. They took some of the facilities that they had built specifically for that tournament, turned it into housing, turned it into athletic centers for kids, turned it into other support facilities for the community. That's actually worked out pretty well. So if your post-event plan is not in place, there's another problem.
And I do think, obviously, that was a fantastic response, by the way. But, you know, so much of that thought process goes to, you know, the foundation of the infrastructure. Do these potential hosting cities already have it set up? Do they need to build it? Obviously, as you mentioned, you know, in the U.S., we do have a pretty good infrastructure system that can support the ability to bring in massive amounts of individuals, you know, from, you know, athletes to fans and properly support them in a way that's safe, that is, you know, reliable, that they can get to these stadiums and facilities, they can lodge somewhere, they can eat somewhere. Like you said, if they need to have any, you know, medical concerns, there's hospitals that can support them. And when you look at countries that are like, wow, we can get, you know, a World Cup, we can get a Olympic, we can get a event that can completely change the course of our country's history, because ultimately what these are, you know, propaganda events to show awesome, cool, look at my country, you know, even going back to like the World Fairs coming to the U.S. and traveling the world and the importance of having those. And obviously we've seen the diminishing returns. We don't have, you know, World Fairs on the same level we used to have, you know, 100 or so years ago. But it's so important that when you take into that whole consideration of how are these infrastructure changes impacting the people that are living there. I mean, you talked about Brazil. Obviously, we saw all those photos where you have this infrastructure going up to support the World Cup, the Olympics, going right next to the favelas. And how is that money going back into the economy of those countries? Well, in the case of Brazil, now that we're looking years later, not very well. I mean, $13 billion for the Olympics. I mean, I think they had to take out like a $500 million loan to kind of get across the finish line. You know, so much money spent to help show off your country, but not enough money spent supporting your country, building the necessary infrastructure to bring your people up to the next level of being able to survive and thrive, and creating a economy that thrives outside of sports. You know, the fact that you have host countries that build these massive stadiums, and then once those massive reasons to have those massive stadiums leave, you can't support a 20, 30, 50, 60, 70,000 person stadium. I mean, in the US, we have that infrastructure. I mean, most college stadiums are bigger than major league stadiums. I mean, I know the Big House at Michigan is, what, 100,000 people. That's a lot of freaking people. But if you put that same capacity stadium in another country that can't support that, that can't fund the operational costs for the businesses and for the communities around that stadium, it's just a gigantic waste of money for a few weeks in the summer or the winter.
It's a gigantic planning failure.
Yes.
You get to the waste of money. All we've done is put money in our pockets. We didn't think past event day, whatever that looks like, whether it's one day, one game, two games, three games, four games, whatever, a two-week span, three-week span, four-week span. We didn't think past that period. We thought about, okay, as the term you use, the propaganda, we thought about that. But we didn't think, well, okay, we're going to do all of this. We're going to house all of these athletes. We're going to figure out a process to feed them and even give them something resembling home as we feed them, or the tours or whatever the case is. And we've got a homeless or poverty-stricken population that we can't support after the tournament.
Yeah, and I think taxpayers across the world, they're more than fine supporting governments, you know, or public systems that support communities, that support a better way of living. I mean, here in the U.S., supporting, you know, roads, supporting police, teachers, librarians, military, all of that is so important. And I'm more than happy, you know, for my taxes to go to that and to see improvements in my infrastructure, to see improvements in my community. But then you have instances like, you know, recently here in Minnesota, we built a new stadium. It's hard to be like, all right, I'm paying for the stadium. You know, we paid through pull tabs, but it's hard to see, you know, these stadiums being built for billionaire owners. I know the Rooney family, for, you know, your favorite team, the Steelers, and to say, well, my money is going to something that, I mean, I think the Brookings Institution came out and basically said these massive stadiums being built have little to no economic impact on the communities that are around them. And so it kind of feels like, all right, I'm paying for a billionaire type investment group to basically hold a city hostage or a country hostage and say, well, somebody else wants the Vikings, somebody else wants the Steelers, somebody else wants the Olympics, somebody else wants the World Cup. I can go somewhere else if you don't want to pay. And I'm touting this ability to say, you're going to have this economic advancement if we come to your city, if we come to your country. But the data just doesn't back that up, unless, I think you perfectly said it, unless you have a post-event plan. You know, obviously getting into the Los Angeles Olympics coming up here in a handful of years, you know, reusing facilities. I mean, I think they're planning for UCLA dormitories, because it is the Summer Olympics, to house a lot of these athletes. Connecting with other states to say, hey, you got a really good facility. Do you mind if we host an event at your facility? We'll deal with the public transportation and getting people there. We just need to use your facilities. And I think that's a smarter way of looking at these, you know, huge world events as a way to obviously do the propaganda of saying, look how awesome Los Angeles is. Look awesome. I mean, Paris is coming up. Look how awesome these are. But also use them as an opportunity to support your community and not just say, I'm going to use my people as a way to make me a quick buck, instead of being like, all right, cool. A lot of people are going to come here. Tourism is going to skyrocket. Hopefully, if we do this right, tourism will skyrocket after. How do we build a long-term goal to improve our city, our state, our country?
So if you, I'm also a Baltimore Orioles fan. As you can tell by this George Jefferson landing strip here,
Gotta love Camden Yards, man. Gotta love Camden Yards.
I'm old enough to remember 1983. I have sat my butt down in those bleachers in right field and left field in old Memorial Stadium on pitcher night when about the seventh inning, you could sit in the right field bleachers and look across to the left field bleachers and see the pitchers flying across the bleachers at other people. Why is that happening as a 6 or 7 year old? Oh, because everybody there is drunk and now they're fighting and they're throwing pitchers at each other. My dad was an old Baltimore Colt fan, so I remember the Mayflower vans leaving Baltimore.
The middle of the night.
Yes. And that was actually on my birthday. So, yeah, my dad was enjoying my birthday that year.
Great reminder of your birthday every year for your dad.
Yeah, that Mayflower flag, because like, I had seen the videos and stuff of it so many times, and then one day, somebody had the actual date underneath it. Okay, all right. I use that Baltimore as a reference point because I believe, and there's a lot into it, but the building of Camden Yards is the center point of gentrification issues we've had for the last 10 to 15 years. Because what happened? The social narratives about Baltimore were there. For some folks, it was like saying Chicago now. You could say Baltimore back then. So what did they do? They went to an unused, rundown area, quote unquote. The owners went in, got the land for cheap, went in, built a downtown stadium. And oh my God, everybody wants to come to downtown Baltimore all of a sudden. This is before The Wire came out. This is before 1996 when the Ravens came. All of a sudden, everybody wants to go to downtown Baltimore, and it's not because of Phillips Seafood War. Now, if you take a look at that, that set a trend across baseball and really sports in general across the country, because this was a time where all the facilities that were built out in suburbia, late 60s, early to mid 70s, were now 20 years old. They pretty much dilapidated or needed work. So what did a lot of the teams do? Well, hell, there's some cheap land downtown. Oh, okay. We'll move the team into a facility downtown. Number one, I got to build a parking garage now, especially with the NFL. I move the stadium downtown and got to build a parking garage. Okay, that's with preseason, maybe 8 to 10. Maybe if, you know, go to the playoffs, 12 or 13 Sundays or Thursday nights or Monday nights or Saturday, depending on, you know, the scheduling. A year, and that's it. So what else am I going to do with this parking garage? Oh, okay, here comes the commercial developers. Well, let's even start further. Here comes Starbucks. Okay. Here comes the commercial developers. Okay, we'll buy out that rundown building. We'll buy out this rundown building, building commercial offices. The parking garage is right there. Okay, said city. Can we use these parking garages to for people in these new downtown commercial offices to park in? Okay, so the city charges. What does that do? You already got a Starbucks, okay? So that's moved some folks out of community, out of what was there. Okay, a couple commercial buildings. Things are still pretty cheap. Well, shucks, here comes Microsoft or somebody like that. We need some corporate offices in said city. Commercial developers back, redo another building. Oh, okay. Then what happens? I work downtown. My little coffee shop's here. I know this nice little restaurant. Well, let me move downtown. Okay, here comes the commercial developer. Rundown building. Okay, here's some more luxury high-rises for the folks working in the Microsoft office, in that Regis commercial development office. Once again, a few more people are moved out of town, moved out of downtown. Now you see the cycle. And now sports is at a place now, and this is one of those behind-the-scenes conversations that hadn't blown up yet. Sports has got to make a decision. Do we want to be suburban, or do we want to stay downtown? The downtown area where that stadium or arena is now has also become an entertainment center. Look at what Mark Cuban and casino family that bought out the Mavs.
Yep, just recently in the past few months, yeah.
Yeah, trying to do now in Dallas. They bought the team, but let Mark Cuban continue to run the basketball operations while they do the casino, luxury casino stuff in Dallas. Mm-hmm. What does that do? Move somebody out of a neighborhood. And then if we're having an honest conversation about that, that's generally a black or brown person. We're at a place now where it's with sports asking itself, okay, are we going back to suburbia? Because when we moved downtown, that was 20 years ago now. That was 15 years ago now. In a facility where I've either got to restructure the IT infrastructure because can't nobody use their Wi-Fi, or it's hard to pick up on the Wi-Fi that's running through the facility. Or from that, we've built up so much parking is atrocious and getting to the stadium is atrocious. And with our American ability to turn our nose up at public transportation, nobody can get to the stadium. So sports is at a crossroads now. And like I said, this is an underlying conversation of, do we want to be suburban or do we want this downtown entertainment center?
As we are getting into these streaming wars within, you know, sports rights and broadcasting rights and the massive amounts of money, Amazon is paying massive amounts of money, Peacock paid massive amounts of money for a exclusive NFL, you know, playoff game this year.
Well, Amazon just did the same thing.
Yeah, they did the same thing. Yeah. And it's a lot of these sports industries chasing this wealth. And obviously, you know, when you chase that wealth, like you said, gentrification happens. You bring in these communities that have wealth, more often than not, white males, and you kick out people that are already there. I mean, your example of Camden Yards, over time, those prices of Oriole tickets rose and rose and rose until it got to a point where people living in that community couldn't even afford to use the infrastructure in their community. And that is something that happens in cities over and over again on, you know, smaller scales, on bigger scales, just increasing those ticket prices. You increase food costs at restaurants. You know, now you have more trendy restaurants that paying $20, $30 for a meal that a restaurant that used to be there, locally cultured food that was half that price. You know, you're pricing out those in the community. I mean, the basic idea of gentrification. And you're saying, well, no, we need the sports team here. We need these people here. I mean, we saw something similar in Oakland where, you know, the owners who moved to Las Vegas said, no, you guys aren't good enough for me. I'm going to where they're willing to completely change their community to fit exactly what I need. And we're seeing that more and more as more massive amounts of money gets into sports where it wasn't before through these, like I said, broadcasting and streaming rights. And now we're seeing these massive shifts following kind of that route when it comes to the Olympics and the World Cup and bigger sporting events in general.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a whole nother conversation of when you speak of the streaming of the RSNs are going to be obsolete soon. And the real issue is the RSNs that aren't on either coast. Because of the way they revenue share in the NFL and really the MLS, you really won't see this. But look at basketball, look at baseball. Two sports where the money can get astronomical because of the way they revenue share. Because of the amount of games they play, they needed the RSNs. They needed that local cable network. What happened to the sports? They got coastal. All the best teams were either on the East Coast. So we talk New York, so we talk Boston, Philadelphia, just go right down the coast. Depending on what the situation was in Baltimore and Washington, you could throw those in there. Maybe the Atlanta team, go further south, Miami. Out here on the West Coast, obviously the Los Angeles teams. You could say the Bay Area, but you're really talking about San Francisco because of the social challenges in Oakland, Silicon Valley, back down to the San Jose area. Those teams are the best teams because I've got MSG, the Yes Network, Nesson. That's a whole nother check for that owner that he doesn't have to spread around to 30 or 32 other owners. I'm not going to get that same check in Cleveland. I might get that same check in Chicago, maybe at Dallas or Houston. I'm not getting that same check in Pittsburgh. Kroenke isn't going to get that same check in Denver. Okay. Real Salt Lake, the Royals, or the Jazz in Salt Lake, Utah, they ain't gonna get that same check that the Buss family is getting for the Lakers. What that's done is that's shifted the balance of talent to either coast. You look at the athletes, they naturally want to be in better social situations, better situations for their brand, better rest and relaxation or situations. And, you know, depending on the situation that I come from, I'm not going to stay in that situation. I'm going to get me a summer house or off-season house in Phoenix. I'm going to move to L.A. or San Diego. If I'm going to stay on the East Coast, yeah, I'm moving to New York or a suburban tri-state.
And you're taking your money out of those communities.
Out of those cities. Transient city, Connecticut, with 1 hour access right into the city. I'm moving to Miami. I'm calling the Heat or I'm calling the Marlins or the Dolphins. Hey, what y'all got? And then I'm going to set up shop in Miami. Outside of Atlanta, like I said, Dallas or Houston or maybe Chicago. I don't want to be disrespectful, but what do I want to be in Cleveland for?
Destroying Cleveland today, Adam. I'm kidding. But no, I get what you're saying. You know, as being in a market here in Minnesota where, you know, we're considered a flyover state when it comes to sports, you know, broadcasting and marketing, you know, even to the point where, you know, some of our baseball games are blacked out. And it's like, I can't watch my local team on my local channel is an absolute travesty. But then when you get obviously to those bigger markets, and I kind of want to move on here because I do want to continue kind of this conversation around money, but I think there is this propensity to move money outside of the communities that you are, obviously it goes even deeper than that, but move money outside of the communities that you're supposed to be bringing in massive amounts of money. And that money is just going in and then it's going right out. But I would like to welcome to the show, Adam L. Spencer. Through Spencer Group International, Adam offers comprehensive services as a sports agent and consultant, bringing a unique blend of military leadership and sports industry expertise to his role. Following 20 years of military service, Adam transitioned into the sports world, driven by his, as we talked about earlier, nerdy love for sports and dedication to building lifelong personal connections with each client to help them achieve success both on and off the field. Adam, welcome to Water Cooler Talk.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Grace, peace, and mercy to you.
So, I mean, kind of getting back to that conversation we were just having in a little different context, you know, in your client pamphlet under the financial thoughts section, you include, I thought, a super interesting question. Do I enjoy the money my name and image are attached to? So as NIL money, name, image, and likeness, you know, continues to freely flow throughout college athletics, you know, obviously super prevalent now with the upcoming release of the college football game, you know, the surge in opportunities for athletes to monetize their brand also comes with this increased risk of exploitation of that brand, where the ability to have this life-changing money, you know, may clash with their personal values, but you put a few million dollars in front of somebody, there's a good chance they're going to be willing to sign yes when they've never seen that before. And it's one of those things where that instant gratification of taking the money now, but also potentially pulling generational money off the table. Basically, you know, when discussing that question with clients, how do you navigate that conversation to convey to them the potential risk associated with, you know, that immediate financial gratification, but also to have them consider, you know, the long-term impact?
That's interesting because I don't try and get too fancy in the conversation. I try and get straight to the point of, okay, if you're going to do this, you know, your branding, marketing, sponsorship, that type of stuff. Okay. What is it you like? And what is it you don't like? Point blank. I don't care how much they're offering you. I don't care what girlfriend says, what mom and dad says. I don't care what this person over here says. You, the athlete, does that Wendy's burger taste good to you or not? Are you having a Coke and a smile or are you drinking Pepsi? Mm-hmm. I believe in cutting through all of that to ensure that, hey, first and foremost, I'm happy with my name, my image, my likeness being on this burger. I don't care how much money Raising Cane's is offering me if I think the chicken is trash and I'm only there for the sauce. Yes, I can take care of some things. But personally, am I happy with that? Because if I'm not happy with that, sooner or later, I'm not going to be happy with me. And 9 times out of 10, the first thing I'm going to do is project that out on everybody else around
me. Mm-hmm. Very good point.
I'm going to project that out on mom and dad who told me, take them, fool, you better take that man good money. I'm going to project it on Uncle So-and-so. I'm going to project it on the girlfriend. I'm going to project it on the agent who brought me the deal. In a way, am I kind of protecting myself? Feel free to say that. Yes. Now, NIL, as it continues to grow, we'll switch this up a lot. But we've gotten to a place in the agent business where you have to get in at the stage where they're young. And at times, depending on the sport, very young.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, one of the stories I sent you was about a 13-year-old getting offered, you know, a contract from Nike.
Right. And that girl, she just scored in her first preseason game. And there's a lot of nuance in that. When you look at that at such a young level, well, youth sports have become suburbanized. May not be suburban kids involved, but they're in places that have access to suburban resources. So first and foremost, there's a lot of social issues within that. That's a whole conversation. That personal trainer that mom and dad got because mom and dad started to live through little 13-year-old, he or she's on Instagram posting the workouts and whatnot. So they're making money off the 13. Said school with the coach and the team scout or whatever that came to watch you, they're posting or on Instagram, they're giving you an offer, hoping you post it so they can start off the recruiting battle, bidding or whatever you, however you want to look at it. So they're eventually, or at least trying to make their financial gains off of it. So why is it we have a problem with the person making money who everybody else is making money off of? Why is that? Why is that from a media perspective? If you look at the media, and I don't care who it is, 90% of the opinion, because we live in such an opinion-based world, nobody wants to deal with facts. 90% of the opinions skew towards the ownership or that leadership group instead of the person making the money. Why is that? Why is that we give so much deference to the coach, the owner, from the college perspective, the school president, or the athletic director or the SID office, and we tell young athlete, no, you signed here, stay your butt there. We're having a cat because so-and-so decided, okay, I want to transfer. I got a phone call from somebody. Yeah, I think I'm going to transfer. I'm going to get me a little bag, maybe play on a bigger platform. Yeah, I'm a transfer. We're losing our mind off of that. But somehow we're comfortable with whoever on the coaching staff, as I said before, the SID, the school AD, or the school president. For that matter, if you're a land grant university, the board, we're just perfectly fine with one of them moving on to the next job or getting fired or finagling the system to get a pay raise. We're perfectly fine with that. Why not the athlete who's making the money? What does that tell us about ourselves? Why are we so scared to just sit there, first and foremost, to come to grips with, in the majority of the revenue-driving sports, you're talking about an athletic population in the majority. Not all, but majority. That start off at, you look at the college level, that start off at 60%, 70% black, depending on the sport and maybe the school, 100% black. So that also means that what you're talking about is football and basketball, those two sports at the college level. Now you can break that down into the men's and the women's, but they're both driving revenue. So we have to look at, okay, these sports start off at 60%, 70% black. So that also means they're going to be female, and maybe LGBTQIA plus identified. Why are we so ready to try and regulate that? We don't want to regulate the coach. We don't want to regulate anybody on the administrative staff from an athletic perspective. We don't want to regulate the president. Why? But we're so up in arms about a 13-year-old getting an NIL deal.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly wise perspective because NIL has completely changed the game in terms of realizing how much true money is involved in something like that. Like just last night, Caitlin Clark of Iowa college basketball was here in Minnesota, and she's, you know, making, I think, $800,000 a year through NIL deals. And this is somebody who's putting women's basketball in the college sphere on the mat the same way, you know, somebody like Cam Newton, you know, completely changed the culture at Auburn and said, hey, you're coming to Auburn, or at least you're coming to these games to watch Cam Newton play. You're coming to, I mean, the latest documentary about Johnny Manziel, you're coming to Texas A&M. Obviously, they have, you know, these built-in fan bases, but you're coming to see these players play. You're coming, you're spending your money to see these certain players, but a large percentage of that, you know, ticket price, those food sales, those jersey sales, those memorabilia sales, they're not going towards Caitlin Clark. They're not going towards Cam Newton. They're not going towards Johnny Manziel. They're going towards, I mean, these institutes. And if you look at the U.S. and you look at the highest paid public people in each state, it's often a sports coach, you know, at one of the universities.
To be clear, it's the football coach.
Yes, the football coach. To be clear, yeah, perfectly.
You look at a state like Kentucky or Indiana, it might be the men's basketball coach at either at University of Kentucky or the University. That may be a little bit different, but for the most part, it's the football coach. Highest paid person in the state.
By far.
Yeah. And you look at a private institution, they don't even have to talk to you about the money.
The NIL is really putting a magnifying glass on, like I said, the amount of true money that is going on, you know, and it's allowing people the transparency to say, is Caitlin Clark worth $800,000 a year? She's probably worth 10 times that because she's bringing so many eyeballs. I mean, we sold out the barn here in Minneapolis last night because of her. I mean, Iowa, I don't know the results of the score, but Iowa's going to blow out Minnesota regardless, just because we don't have a great, you know, women's basketball team. Unfortunately, I was right in this, but the final score of the game was Iowa 108, Minnesota 60. But the fact that somebody's coming, you know, even in the NBA, when you look at LeBron James and, you know, when the Lakers go and play away games, people are coming to see LeBron James. Yeah, they might, you know, also want to see the Lakers, but they're coming to see LeBron James. And obviously the NBA is dealing with this load management issue where it's like, well, why is LeBron going to go? Obviously, you might play, you know, a little more in Cleveland, you know, not to harp too much on Cleveland today, but you know, you get into those smaller market cities, there's a good chance, you know, if the team's not good, LeBron's not going to play. He's not going to suit up. And so the NBA is dealing with that load management of, all right, well, how do we ensure that if the Lakers are coming to town and you're buying a ticket to see the Lakers, if you're buying a ticket to see LeBron, because this may be the only chance you get to see him play, that he plays. And obviously, you know, there's months more nuanced conversation around that. And I mean, LeBron can't play every single game for every single, you know, season of his career. It's just not possible. But at what point do you have to balance that there's so much money going into these, you know, for instance, tickets that, yeah, we need you there, but also we need you there for the long run as well.
NBA is a very, very interesting place. And I think there's a lot of nuance where the league didn't look at itself. Because everybody wants to have this load management conversation, but we keep leaving out Greg Popovich and the Spurs. I believe it was either the 2014 or the 2011. I think Kawhi was on the team, so it was probably 2014. The Spurs have this back-to-back, and the backing game is on TNT. And I want to say they played a team in Florida, so bye about them, and it wasn't Miami. So the Magic, I think Dwight had left the Magic by then, and the Magic were kind of, I believe it was they were going to play the Magic. And these reports that Tim Duncan, Manu, and Tony Parker aren't going to play. The teams in, if I remember correctly, Florida getting ready to go to the game, and people see Tim, Manu, Tony Parker getting ready to get on the flight, looking perfectly fine to go back to San Antonio. We harp on LeBron not playing. We harp on Anthony Davis not playing, Tatum or whoever not playing, and don't go back to, okay, this was done from within. The load management issue that we lose our minds over at times was done from within. Start there. Start there with that accountability conversation. And then you present, because if you don't, you present more of a social issue. Well, we know the NBA is 80% black. Why is this a player issue when the genesis of this is Greg Popovich and a respected organization like the Spurs? Why are we throwing all the venom to LeBron? if he decides, okay, I'm going to shut it down. And one of the things within this conversation that we should also probably do is listen to J.J. Redick's comments on this, where he breaks down how much the game has changed, how up and down the game is, how much more basketball people are playing. By the time they're 18 or 19, they've already got body issues because I'm from Ohio and play in our AAU team that's based in Los Angeles. So at age 13, I was flying back and forth to go play 6 or 7 games of basketball in a weekend at age 13. And if I'm doing that, I probably got a trainer at home that's only focused on developing my body for basketball. And oh, by the way, if I'm that good, I'm probably at least 6'5", 6'6". If I go beyond that, 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", 6'11", 7 feet tall, you're talking about the natural leg issues that come into play now. Why is it that we forget all of that and we focus on LeBron didn't play tonight?
Like, we're taking away the potential nuanced conversation to explore some of these systematic issues that, and I think this is across everything, Adam. I think this is not just related to sports. It's like, we're not willing to look at those systematic issues because it's a lot more easier to blame LeBron for not playing than address our own discomforts.
And I got it, because there's been these things where 10-year-old girl flew all the way from China to Target tonight because LeBron's going to be there. That's the cheapest ticket mom and dad could get. That's the one time we could get vacation. And Steph didn't play. Or Steph stayed back in San Francisco. Or LeBron didn't show up. And oh, by the way, this is a Tuesday night on TNT. And all of this now is public information for us to run to our corner zone on Beyonce's internet. Get on Twitter and X, whatever you want to call it now, and run to our corners. So, yeah, it's a lot more nuanced than what we want to talk about. It's very problematic for me because we don't have the full conversation.
When I think, obviously, this next story will kind of get into that conversation a bit more. But obviously, before we move on, myself and Water Cooler Talk have embarked upon a mission to give back to various parts of the community and those who have helped build our show to where it stands today. For each new episode of the podcast, the guests will bring with them a charity of their choice to represent. On the day of their episode going live, Water Cooler Talk will give a donation to that charity in honor of the guest, as well as a global platform to spread a message of love, hope, and togetherness. And we invite you, listening to this episode, to join in to help spread that message to your own personal audience. Adam, your charity of choice for today's episode is the Black Veterans Project. Can you share with us, you know, a bit of the significance of their work, you know, obviously considering your background and the importance of supporting veterans?
Oh, the Black Veterans Project. Oh, my goodness. They do so much work from a community perspective of, first and foremost, advocacy for Black veterans. That's first and foremost what's such an important piece for me personally. There's also support from a military justice perspective. I don't know if you remember it, but there was a 60 Minutes interview maybe 2 years ago, where they had a Black Air Force captain, I believe he was, fighter pilot, first and foremost, and not that many Black fighter pilots in the Air Force. And he speaks about having to navigate the space, and not only the space in the military, but the officer space as a Black man. He speaks about having to lower the tone, taking the bass out of his voice so no one thinks he's threatening. Oh my God, there's so many connotations within that alone. Then there's also General Austin, who is now being grilled in front of Congress, or at least was this morning. When he first took the job as Secretary of Defense, he does a Facebook post, and he says, although I am the first, I hope I'm not the last. And this was as the pandemic is going on. Man, I saw that just folded like good sheets. Balled up like a little girl. I was through. And so organizationally, what they do is if you go on their website, you can see them. One of the first things on there is secure the legacy and fight for equity. I had uncles who had to fight for the GI Bill coming back from World War II. I was lucky enough to be able to use a VA loan to buy a house in Washington State when I was stationed down at Fort Lewis. Pretty smooth process. I've got uncles who went through hell and high water to get that. I've had my mother reach out to me to try and get help for one of my uncles that had seen combat and was having some housing challenges, and we couldn't get the paperwork straight. And so we went through a lot of different things just to get him help until he left this earth. That organization, they do so much for Black veterans, and it is such an important thing for me. My own disability rating, I had to go through Senator Murray's office, and shout out to Senator Murray. I did the paperwork, everything, and went through the process, went through the exams, all of it. Came back as we acknowledge some of these injuries and health issues, but we're giving you 0%. These are just some of the things that Black veterans go through coming home and having to put up with what we've put up with throughout our military careers, however long that lasted. Black women, with the situation with Black women, that's a whole nother kit and caboodle, from the health issues to some of the maternity challenges. Black Veterans Project is just so important.
No, I very much appreciate you bringing them on the show today. And obviously, this is a project that means a lot to you. And I think, you know, even how you talk about it shows that. And I think listeners and myself, you know, see the importance of organizations like this and the benefits that they provide everyone.
Thank you for letting me talk about them. I appreciate it. I'm so appreciative for that.
Well, all right, Adam, are you ready to jump into our final news story of the episode here today?
Hey, let's go.
All right, this is from Global Sports Matter Opinion, written by Jamal Murphy, July 26, 2022. Sports media needs more athlete apologists. Journalists want to get the story right. Their aim is to be as accurate as possible when telling a story for the benefit of the audience. The more a topic or subject is understood, the more accurate and truthful the story will be. The closer you can come to thoroughly understanding a subject, whether by research, life experience, or just an innate connection, the more authentic the story. Yet, a notable disparity exists in sports reporting, where the voices telling the stories often fail to represent the diversity of the athletes they cover. According to the job market research firm Zipia, the vast majority of sports journalists in the United States are male, white, and over 40. Basically, Ray Romano from Everybody Loves Raymond. The mismatch becomes particularly glaring when considering the diversity of athletes, especially in major sports like football, basketball, and baseball. The disparity of diversity in sports journalism not only skews storytelling, but also undermines the credibility of the profession. In a study from the University of Texas, news distrust among Black Americans is a fixable problem. Over 1,000 Black Americans were asked to grade news coverage of Black communities being done by U.S. journalists on a scale of 1 to 7. The average of the answer was a paltry 3.3. Whether it's bias, ignorance, or outright malice, Black athletes and other athletes of color are often mischaracterized or misperceived by members of the media. Those who speak differently, dress differently, or express themselves differently are characterized as having negative traits. NFL star Odell Beckham Jr. was characterized by the media as a selfish player and a poor teammate during his tenure with the New York Giants and Cleveland Browns, despite teammates consistently having overwhelmingly positive comments about him and his locker room presence. Allen Iverson, NBA legend, came into professional sports with baggage and a criminal record from his teen years. He identified with hip-hop culture, he donned tattoos and a signature shooting sleeve before Black fashion became mainstream in sports. I remember I had a shooting sleeve because of Allen Iverson. But back during his early playing days, many in the mainstream sports media looked at him as thuggish and a threat, rather than seeing a young man from a different background and culture looking to find himself on the biggest stage. Like everyone else, Beckham and Iverson were hardly perfect, and the media had a right to point out their mistakes. Media members often have their own agendas, which include telling and creating stories that are unique and bring attention to their publications. As NBA veteran and attorney Len Elmore points out, it's about getting, quote, something different than the competition. Whether it's an understanding of the music that is popular with today's athletes or the slang they use in and outside the locker room, having writers and reporters who understand and appreciate the culture of those who they are covering goes a long way towards fairly and more accurately representing them. Len Elmore, who played in New York and New Jersey, continues, quote, I think what tempers the final product would be experience and then personal integrity. It's hard for a lot of brothers to tear down athletes of color in a way that hurts them when in fact they can look at how difficult it was for themselves. End quote. Journalists who can relate to and tell the athlete side of the story are not apologizing for the athlete. Instead, they are trying to accurately portray their story. When it comes to an athlete's media portrayal, there has been no more controversial issue than social or political activism. Treating athletes as if their social or political opinions should not be heard or hold no weight to quote-unquote shut up and dribble is akin to denying them their humanity. Those who disregard stories that deal with athlete activism are essentially saying the same thing to athletes. We don't care about you, outside of your athletic exploits, and we will not tell your full story or present you accurately. It's been said that journalism's first obligation is to the truth. As fans, we deserve stories that reflect the diversity and complexities of an athlete's experience, both on and off the playing field. So Adam, a key component of your work is this mantra, a seat at the table. You know, everyone has the right to make the most of their voice and platform. How do you see increased representation and diversity in sports journalism allowing athletes to do exactly that, you know, make the most of their voice?
So I've got a number of thoughts off of what you just laid out there. JJ Redick was on First Take. This is where the KD interview, where he sits down with his agent and they kind of do this podcast thing. He speaks on a lot of different things. And I thought the conversation and the narratives behind what he was doing so appropriate for this. So that's number one. Number two, when you mention Allen Iverson, it touches a different space for me. I played football against him in the ninth grade.
Okay.
My sister was playing basketball right around the same time. My senior year, we played against Bethel High School at home, and they walked out on the field to the middle of the field like this, 10 fingers. He wore the number 10 on the football field. I vividly remember everything about that bowling alley incident from a local onlooker's perspective. Not that I was there, but there is a lot in that that kind of tainted who he was and gave the media fodder to shape who he was or what they thought he was from that incident. Where I'm from in Virginia, Gloucester County, our area code is 804, but by the time I was a teenager, we had grown so much. And this is still a period where folks had to use antennas and things of that nature for their television. When we got cable, and I believe it was either 86 or 87A, we was in.
Changed the game.
You was talking, you go to school, talk crazy. So that happens about 86 or 87. I start high school, and not me and him start high school at different schools in 1990. From an athletic perspective, we played in the same district. So we were going to see Bethel High School once a year in football, twice a year in basketball, and, you know, in other sports from a high school perspective. So I got to see the 3 years of the Allen Iverson experience because in seventh, eighth grade, I went to this summer program for Black students at William & Mary. And there was numerous Black students that got together from around the state. And you kept hearing this thing, Bubba Chuck, these people talking. The hell is a bubble check? All right, whatever. And so by about the ninth grade, you keep hearing about this guy. Bethel High School's got a guy that they think might be it. So in the 10th grade, they were really good in football. And the basketball team just takes off at this thing called the Fort Eustis Christmas Tournament on what was Fort Eustis in Virginia. And you would see Tommy Anika was an assistant coach at Duke at the time. He was in the stands. You would see, you name it, head coach in the stands during one of those games from when me and him were in the 10th grade to the 11th grade. You would see all of these different coaches in the stands, these NBA people in the stands watching. Our 11th grade year, in February of that year, Valentine's Day weekend, there's this major story in the Daily Press about Allen Iverson, but you're also hearing about this fight that breaks out the same weekend at Victory Lanes.
The name of the bowling alley was Circle Lanes. So for any future references to the bowling alley, the name is Circle Lanes.
Okay, so a couple of days later, the tape comes out, and you can't see anything on the tape. If you go back and look, there is no way in hell you can pick out Allen Iverson in the tape that was used to quote unquote implicate him as being involved in the fight. The local yokels, they had their own narratives. Like if he had went to Hampton High School instead of Bethel High School, because Hampton High School was the monster. Football, basketball, it was legacy. It was it. If there was local yokels who would tell you, hey, if he had went to Hampton High School, none of this would have been a thing. This would have been a water under the table. The judge on the case went to Hampton High School.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where, you know, high school sports are bigger than just the sport.
Right.
And the impact of them reaches deep.
Until I saw Kobe Bryant in Portland in 2013, I'd have told anybody that Allen Iverson experience for 2-3 years was, I'd have told anybody, I had never seen anything like it. And that was coming off of seeing Terry Kirby, Chris Slade, the three, 4 years before at Tab High School, when we were in a lower division, we were playing against them. This is also my senior year. I got to play against Aaron Brooks, David Macklin, and Dre Bly. All of these guys that would end up with some medium of a pro career, we were playing against. Till I went to Portland in 2013, I told anybody there is nothing like Bethel High School Allen Iverson. So there was nothing like that. And then my senior year, I really got heavy into journalism because that's what I started off wanting to do when I went to Hampton University. My senior year of high school, I really got heavy into journalism. And as part of journalism class, my final paper was the story of the bowling alley incident. So I had to research it and all of these different things. I had read the sports, there was a Sports Illustrated article. I had read everything. Of course, being locally connected to it was, you know, there was a lot of different things you'd heard, but reading some of the articles really made more clear the polarization of what was going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, you know, there's also the story of the white lady who are from Pocosin of all places. If you know anything about that local area in Virginia, you say Pocosin and folks, black folks especially, women, huh? Oh yeah, don't go down there after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But there was a lady, she helped him get his GED so he could get into Georgetown. The way so many folks wrote about him, it was just unreal. And the next layer of that was when we first got to high school, Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, Ray Jackson, they were at Michigan going through this same type of experience on a national level. That really touched so many different parts of me personally growing up hearing about that. Because they used to beat the crap out of me. Oh my God, they used to beat the crap out of me. So that Sprite commercial with him and Jadakiss kind of sent me a certain way when it first happened. But, you know, growth teaches you a lot.
Well, no, I think, I mean, to kind of the point you had there when, I mean, you're looking back at this and you're seeing how it's being written about, you know, this situation at Victory Lane and kind of how the community talked about it and then the national community talked about it and seeing how important it is for what was Allen Iverson's voice and being able to tell his side of the story in that. I mean, now we have, I mean, more publications like, I believe, the Players Tribune, where they allow, you know, players to say, this is my side of the story. Because we spend so much time in these spheres where it's people that, you know, they're in within, you know, these communities, but they're not actually the players that are, you know, stepping on the court, that are stepping up to bat, that are putting on the pads. You know, they might have some background in, you know, playing at a younger time in their life. But man, when you get to the league, it's a way different ball game than playing high school football, playing Tyke football, playing AAU basketball. You know, the competitiveness is on a completely other level. I think Brian Scalabrine said, you know, something along the lines of, I'm closer to, can't remember if it was Jordan or LeBron, than you are to me. And that's a good point to say, yeah, we have a completely disconnected viewpoint of how players, and obviously as we talk more about sports dominated by black and brown athletes, that we don't have enough of those voices when we have, you know, Ray Romano, you know, the typical Ray Romano character telling their stories, because it's very hard for a white 40 plus year old man to still tell a story of a black teen coming into the league, you know, going back to kind of LeBron James coming into the league straight out of high school. Who's telling his story? It wasn't LeBron at that time.
Brian Windhorst. if we ever told the truth, Windhorst is who he is now because he was in Akron covering LeBron James in high school. If we ever just told it for what it is, you know, we're not trying to cast aspersions or be disrespectful to anybody. But if we ever told, just cut to the chase, we know Brian Windhorst because of LeBron James. And not this LeBron James, 15, 16, 17-year-old LeBron James. That's why we know Windhorst. And the thing about it is now, just like the agency game, the connection with players now to, I guess, get them to open up, you have to know them at such a younger age. And too often, there's not a conversation of, just to keep it 100, why are we talking to this white reporter? Mom and dad, okay, if you're going to let him or her do the interview, isn't there a black reporter on television that you can say, hey, we want to talk to him, control the narrative? Or isn't there a black paper writer that's in the stands at the game saying, hey, Sonny, come here. No. Talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the new, much more underlying, nuanced conversations that are starting to happen in sports spaces, and especially amongst black folks. Hey, can we give our patronage, can we give our conversations to black reporters who understands us, who understands why you don't have a profile at Great Clips, who understands why your hair is lined up a certain way, or who understands the meaning of your locks or why you have them, who understands, okay, why you're listening to young NBA boy or Saweetie or Ice Spice, whoever, you know, why you're getting into debates about who is better, Drake or Jay-Z. This is just for an example, but, you know, understanding the true nuances of why you're doing what you're doing. And that's becoming a conversation in black spaces now, especially from an athletic perspective of, okay, who am I giving my story to?
I like that. Yeah, because, I mean, it's understanding that there's, I mean, complex layers to telling the story, getting the story right. You know, it's not just, I'm hearing what you're saying, I'm writing it down, and then I'm going out and publishing it. There's a lot of, you know, at least good journalism is focused around creating a story based on truth that tells perspectives that we don't often hear, you know, allowing for, you know, those broader perspectives, allowing for increased visibility as, you know, as a white man, my perspective on the world is very different from a black man. And, you know, those are both stories to tell, but my story has been told a lot more than that other story has been told. And I think that allows that ability and that empowerment to say, my story needs to be told, my story matters, and I need the correct person to tell my story, because otherwise it's going to be told in a way that doesn't make the impact it should.
Right. And there's a lot of nuance in that because of where we are with journalism. You know, I didn't complete it. I'm back in school now for business management. I didn't complete journalism, but I did study. I did do some studying. One of the things I've spoken about earlier is we don't want to deal with fact. We don't want to deal with nuance, especially in the world we live in now with social media. In a world where, you know, to be bluntly honest, what we're doing right now, where all you need is a camera and a microphone and a laptop, and you're providing information, no matter the experience, no matter the journalistic ability you had, whatever that feels like, whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
We're in such a space where we want to sit and talk like this, but we don't want the nuance. We don't want the factual information. We just want to sit down, talk like this, and then go run to our corners instead of, it's fine. This is great. This is a great conversation, but there's nuance. There's factual information that, okay, me yelling and screaming at some dude in his basement in North Dakota is not going is not going to cover, because he's with some Cheetos, in his basement in North Dakota, yelling and screaming on Beyonce's internet with his little Twitter fingers. And I'm way over doing the exact same thing back and forth. You're not getting to the nuance. You're not getting to factual information. And you're not getting any chance of social dynamics getting involved in the conversation for better understanding for everybody involved.
It truly starts with understanding that there are these issues that people different than you are facing, and being able to have the empathy to listen and say, oh shit, yeah, my life is this way, your life is that way. I need to sometimes take the time to listen, to hear what's being said, because I don't have the full picture. You know, life is this complex puzzle and I'm just a small piece in that. And to be able to figure out this puzzle, to be able to finish this puzzle, I need to be able to connect with other communities. I need to connect with other people. I need to understand the nuances, the layers of how do I get those other puzzle pieces to help complete this crazy thing that we're all a part of in life.
And to the root of the question, this is the Skip Bayless issue. Point blank.
Oh, don't we all love Skip Bayless, right?
You know, Skip Bayless has a history of reporting aspersions about Troy Aikman and his sexuality. Skip Bayless did a lot of the investigative reporting that got SMU the death penalty. Skip Bayless is the centering point. Everybody loves to blame. No, Skip blames Stephen A. No, Skip Bayless is the center point of a lot of the debate television you see in sports now. Everybody loves to blame. No. Blame Stephen A. No. It's Skip Bayless. Don't want to cast any aspersions on the man, but we have to have a critique of the legacy that he's putting out there now.
I mean, anyone with a phone and a half-baked question can be a quote-unquote journalist. And, you know, I do think there is a responsibility of these sporting industries and athletes working together, you know, to ensure, you know, fair and accurate coverage, and to realize that, and it shouldn't have to be, because this is how stupid this is going to sound, but making it very clear that these athletes are humans. I mean, speaking of KD, there's that video where, you know, fans are calling him a bitch, and then he stops and says, "What'd you just say to me?" And obviously they back down, and everyone's like, "Oh man, you know, Twitter fingers, KD's a bitch." And it's just like, this is a real human being who has family, who has friends, that this is something that he loves doing. He puts on this, you know, quote unquote show for you every night. And at the same time, just because he's playing for a different team that's not your team, he went to Texas and you went to Alabama, or you went to a rival school, Oklahoma, now KD's a bitch, when this is a real person. This is a person that has feelings, that has, just like you and me talking here, it's all these things that we don't realize, because we see athletes, we see celebrities, we put them on these pedestals, which, do they deserve or not? I think that's a question for another day. I mean, I think they have a cultural impact that is bigger than just playing a game, you know, bigger than just shutting up and dribbling, bigger than, you know, selling out arenas, bigger than capturing their... Jay-Z and Drake were having that conversation, you know, Drake selling out arena shows. Jay-Z's one of the most richest black men in America because they had a cultural impact that people connected with that got them to that point. And we need to start having that conversation around how do we find the empathy to see that these are everyday people just like you and me, but they found something to connect with the culture, and they took it and they rode it off into the sunset.
In light of the incidences of the last few weeks or so, you spoke about, you know, the incident with KD in the arena. What happened there is the corporate version of the deeper narratives and the deeper issues within that court storming issue. The things that made Cameron Indoor such a tough place to play. They got a crazy crowd, the Cameron crazies. Well, there's nuance and social issues that undergird those things that we try and embellished to such greatness that leads to the audacity to call KD a bitch when he's running out to the court. That leads to the audacity because the NBA, NFL, they're not going to have you running out and storming the field. So what happens is, because I paid a ticket and I'm drunk now, I can say whatever I want to. It's levels to it. And you know, if you step down from the college level, it's what other parents are saying about these kids at high school, youth league, AAU events. I hate to do this, but the Cam Newton situation, look at that. That incident with KD is nothing but a corporate level version of the issues that we don't want to deal with the court storming.
And you're talking about the court storming that the player got injured.
Right.
Duke, or was it?
Yeah, Kyle Filipowski at Duke. He gets injured, you know, as fans are storming the court. And the folks from Duke complaining about it is really, really rich for me. Those folks complaining about fans is really, it's a lot of audacity. It's a lot of privilege and audacity in that when if you're a Duke fan complaining about other fans.
That's pretty fair. But no, I think there is that, you know, riding that fine line and kind of going back to talking about this, the release of this, you know, college football NCAA 25. And one of the big focuses that at least they're striving for, and obviously I hope, you know, they hit because NCAA 14, I still play that game. It's so awesome. But one of the big things they're striving for is that real authentic college experience. If you go to Penn State for a whiteout, what that feels like. If you go to the Red River Rivalry, what that feels like in the stands. We are glorifying this intense, passion, you know, the best verbiage there, but this intense passion, we're glorifying it to a point where when they do storm the court and a player gets injured, well, just seconds ago, you were saying, let's storm the court. It's something we've been doing for years. You know, we're building these tolerances to saying it's okay to be passionate. It's okay to pull out a gun at a, you know, Super Bowl parade over an argument because we're passionate about sports. And I think there does have to be that conversation about, yeah, we can be passionate about our sports team. We can be passionate. So many videos of people breaking TV screens when their team loses or, you know, having aggressive instances. You can love your favorite team. Man, I love the Chicago Cubs. And when they won in 2016, I was jumping around the house like crazy. Like there's ants in my pants. I was going crazy for that. You know, when the Saints won the Super Bowl, I remember that onside kick to start the second half. I was like, that's the coolest shit I've ever seen in my life. You can be passionate about sports and have those passions, but there is a line where you have to understand it's just a game. It's just a game. It's just two teams. It's, you know, if it's a single sport, you know, it's one person against whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, it's a game. It's for entertainment. And you got to go home. And like you said at the very beginning of this conversation, you go back to your life. Whatever that background may be.
I'll preface this by saying in 04, I was a sergeant in Germany, and one of my troops was a Red Sox fan when they finally broke the curtain. I get the passion, okay, but, you know, there's a line. And we won't ever understand that because we lack nuance. Mm-hmm. Why do we lack nuance? Because we're scared of... For as much information as we take in, and anybody under 35 takes in, we don't have, first and foremost, enough factual information going around for the amount of information we take in. We don't have enough factual information. We're not educated in a proper way with facts, no matter how uncomfortable they may be. I mean, look at me. I spent 20 years in the United States military. I came in before September 11th and left long after September 11th. There's uncomfortable facts. When we leave out the factual portion, we leave out knowledge. And so there's no way we can be nuanced to. I see what you're saying. No, we're in a place where I'm at my home in Los Angeles, and like I said, you in your basement in North Dakota, and we throwing barbs back at each other on Twitter. In not one instance was there a fact passed back and forth. It's kind of a place of where we are right now, and it's troubling. The news of the day, we're never going to solve it until we get to a place where I can deal with uncomfortable fact. I can sit there and say, yeah, that did happen. Yeah. That shit was some trash. You know, no matter my background, I can sit there and say, yeah, that's some trash. And then I can take my background and give a diverse and nuanced perspective on it with the centering point of, yeah, that shit was some trash. Just facts.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you for taking the time to share your perspective on some of the strangest and most bizarre news stories the world has to offer in an engaging, productive, and meaningful conversation. Listeners, if you'd like to continue to hear more from Adam, follow along as he leads the next generation of sports stars, you can do so by following him through his Instagram at Spencer Group International. Once again, on the old Instagram machine at Spencer Group International. And of course, those links and any additional links will be included in the episode description and on our podcast website, www.watercoolertalkpod.com. So Adam, we have now gotten to my favorite part of the show, part where I hand off the show. You know, one listener called, "A funhouse packed with news so absurd that you're torn between laughter and tears," to you to close it out however you see fit. You know, you have spent many years as a leader, leading those onto their next objective, the next step in their life. Now it's only right for you to take the mic and lead us all home. So Adam, the mic is hot, the light shape right, and the floor is yours.
So obviously, the military is a very important piece of my life. It's good, it's bad, it's indifferent. So I'll take you back to 1942-ish, 1943-ish. The Army has decided to allow women to join the military and join the fight in World War II. They established something called WACS, or Women's Army Corps. After a period, after it's established, obviously white women are the first ones to be allowed in. After a period, black women are allowed to join the Women's Army Corps in very segregated terms, but they're allowed. Post-enlistment, after all enlistment documents are signed, they've done their fingerprinting and all of that other great stuff. There's a story that black women, after enlistment, held up two fingers. One finger was for the battle at home. The other finger was for the battle abroad. So I challenge you all to, first and foremost, think about that experience as a black woman, 1943-ish. The experience of black soldiers in general during that period, going off to a foreign country, fighting a battle at home and a battle abroad. So if you see me in the streets doing this, that's where it's from. But I also would challenge you to ask yourself, what's the battle for you at home, and what's the battle for you in the broader sense? So once again, one is for the battle at home, the other is for the battle abroad, and we thank you.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you so much for having this conversation today. I can see where you get your passion from and just the way you speak and the stories you tell. You're such a great storyteller. And yeah, I think journalism is there for you if you still want to continue that path. You know, go back to Hampton College, get it done. But a lot of my favorite journalist icons, a lot of their best advice boils down to just, you have to start somewhere. You have to start the story somewhere. You have to start, you know, peeling back the layers somewhere. And I think when it comes to addressing a lot of these systemic issues that have plagued our country and other countries for hundreds upon thousands of years, you have to start pulling back those layers and, you know, start allowing people to, as you say, have a seat at the table and really create an inclusive environment that allows for broader perspective, that allows for the ability to have empathy that not everyone has the same life you have. And I appreciate you coming on the show today and having a conversation where we start peeling back at least a bit of those layers.
Well, as I said earlier, grace, peace, and mercy to you. I am honored to have an opportunity on your platform, and thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, you know what? The thing I love is the name I've interviewed the most is Adam, and they've all been fantastic conversations. I don't know what that says about my ego, but listeners, we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, the show will be over. Peace.
This is the story of a podcast that takes weird news from across the world. And while many of these stories may seem fake, they're absolutely not, because they're real.